Accession number 17970, Reel 3.
Squadron Leader Johnson, Reel 3.
Yes, when we got to the SOP, it was difficult to find in the first place because it was quite misty. But we had to attack across the length of the dam, which meant going down the mountainside on one side and then up and out on the other side. There was the additional hazard on the line of approach of a church steeple on the coming up from the hillside. And so we had to avoid that, lifting the wing slightly to get over it, try and get down to height. And we actually made 10 attacks before we released the bomb. It seemed to us all that there was no question, no reason why we should just, the dam wasn't defended, we weren't having any real trouble, although it was difficult, we weren't having real trouble with the flying. And there seemed no point in making that journey if we couldn't do the job that we'd been sent to do. So, as I say, it took us 10 runs to get it exactly right. And when we dropped, the mines were all set with a depth device so that they exploded at 25 feet, which gave the aircraft time to get out of the way before the plume of water was shot into the air. When we came back to have a look after we'd dropped, the crown of the dam had been crumbled, but there was no sign of any actual breakage. We, in fact, were the first of that wave to get to that dam. Although 6 aircraft were briefed, we were the only ones to get there. One had been shot up over the islands coming in, and the shot had ruined his intercom, so that there was no way that they could talk to each other. Another one had flown too low over the North Sea, and the bomb had been ripped off the aircraft. And the rest were lost through various enemy actions. So we were the first to get to that dam. Barnes Wallis had said that it would need at least 6 mines to crack it. And then, having been cracked, the water would do the rest. Because it was such a thick earthenware core, far thicker than either of the others. Unfortunately, we didn't have 6. We had just 1. Until later, when a second aircraft, a reserve aircraft, made it. And again, had great difficulty in finding the dam, made the attack, but with no positive result. As we came home, we flew back over the Mone, or what had been the Mone Dam. And it was just like an inland sea. Nothing but water was visible for literally miles. It really was quite a sight. When we came back, we landed. And, oh dear, the right wing was very low. And in fact, the hit that had occurred was a piece of shrapnel going through the undercarriage nacelle and bursting the tyre. And this, of course, we didn't find out until we landed. They also found a second piece lodged in the fuselage underneath the navigator's feet. So, in fact, we had been hit, although not severely damaged. It could easily have been much more serious for the navigator, particularly.
Who was in the aircrew of your plane?
Captain was Joe McCarthy, Flight Lieutenant McCarthy, an American in the Royal Canadian Air Force. The navigator was Don McLeod, RCAF. The flight engineer was, you must forgive me, names have memories sort of disappear quite frequently.
It'll be on record anyway.
Yes, it's, well.
Don't worry about it.
I'll check it later.
Just go for it.
Yeah. The front gunner was Ron Batson. The wireless operator was Len Eaton. And the rear gunner, those two were both RAF. And the rear gunner was Dave Roger, who was a Canadian.
How did you feel when you got back? What was the mood?
I think it was satisfied that we had done what we went to do. But bitterly disappointed at the number of crews that we'd lost. We lost, in fact, 8 that particular evening. 8 out of a starting 19. 2 of which had returned early.
Did you have much personal contact with Barnes Wallace?
Only on the night before the briefing, when he was telling us about the bomb and how what would happen, how it was developed and so on. And again at briefing when he described how the what he felt would be required to breach each of the dams. He was... I don't recall him being still in the operations room when we got back, but I'm sure he must have been, because I think he stayed until the bitter end to make sure that... they were quite certain that none of the crews had, that were missing could in fact return. And he was very emotionally upset by the fact that his invention had caused so much death.
What impression did he make on you as a man?
A very... determined man, one who was quite convinced of his work and was convinced that it would work. Perhaps a trifle shy, but I would have thought, and this I suppose is a result of subsequent reading, his dealings with the hierarchy in the early stages were pretty blustery, and he in fact had some considerable difficulty in proving his point and getting this particular raid approved.
What did he look like?
Grey-haired, tall, glasses. Slightly stooped. A cheery face, yes, cheery face. I suppose that's all I could really say about him. I had the privilege of attending his 80th birthday party much later on. And he was, apart from being whiter rather than grey, and of course, obviously, much older, he seemed quite his cheerful self. But of course, he didn't last very long after that.
Did he look like the stereotype of a boffin?
He did almost, yes.
Did you know Guy Gibson very well?
Inasmuch as an NCO on the squadron can know Guy Gibson, yes. I always have to be careful what I say about Guy Gibson, because he did a wonderful job on this particular occasion. He was renowned before he came to 617 as being a almost brutal squadron commander. When he came to 617, from his previous associates who were also on the squadron, he seems to have cooled down quite considerably. And one wonders if that was because he knew what he'd get to get out of these crews, and so he was going to have to treat them a little more gently. Occasionally he had his bursts. I remember on one occasion we were having a briefing, and the question of security was raised. And I remember one of the young Canadian officers was hauled in front of the rest of the squadron to be told off because he'd phoned his girlfriend the night before to say that he wouldn't be able to see her because we'd got something on. And that didn't go down well at all. Of course, during the preparation for that operation, all telephones were monitored. All letters were censored. Security was absolutely first class. Really, you just couldn't move without out of place without somebody noticing and being hauled up for it.
So did Guy Gibson explode about this breach of security?
Oh, he did, yes, very much so. I say, he really tore this young officer a strip in front of the rest of the squadron.
You witnessed that, did you?
Yes, yes indeed. It was certainly a salutary lesson to anybody else, I think. But it was the sort of thing, he was also capable of getting what he wanted from the hierarchy. And there was an occasion, I understand, although I didn't, I have no witness of it, but I understand that there was an occasion when there was something which he wanted for the squadron, and somebody at command or group had said, no, you can't have it. And he said, right, I'm in this office until somebody says yes. And he did stay in the office until somebody said yes, he could have it. I don't know what the incident was, but that was a typical example of him dealing and getting what he wanted.
Did you ever get wrapped over the knuckles by him?
No. No. Nor did I get any praise either.
Do you remember whether any other particular personalities who stand out in your mind from 617?
I suppose one, the subsequent squadron commander, Leonard Cheshire, was a totally different man. An extremely capable and good squadron commander. And I recall his opening address to the squadron was, if you get into trouble off duty, I will do what I can to help you. If you get into trouble on duty, then I will make sure that you pay the price. Which was a good way to tell us that of exactly where we stood. And he stuck by that. And he did support anybody who inadvertently got into trouble. And he did, in fact, criticise very severely anybody who, you know, didn't toe the line on the job. I would describe him as a real gentleman, in actual fact. And he behaved as such as the squadron commander. Um, other characters, well, Mickey Martin was a character on his own, the Australian. Several of the Australians that I remember particularly, Bob Hay was the squadron bombing leader, and he was killed on a single shot, came through the nose and killed him outright. He was the only one on the crew. We had a wireless operator. What was his name? Anyway, when we were going down to London, we went down as a squadron for the investiture. And going down on the train, he was debagged by the rest of the lads and was running up and down the corridor in his underpants. He was quite a character. We had another one, a gunner called Buckley, who said he reckoned that he could drink Joe under the table, Joe McCarthy. Well, Buckley was, let's just get a sort of physical comparison. Buckley was 5 feet plus. Joe was well over 6 and built in the same sort of way, outwards as well as upwards. And so they had one non-operational session. They had a competition. And it started in the bar at lunchtime. And after the bar had closed, they had their little kip in the afternoon and came down for bar opening at 6 o'clock in the evening. And at 7:30, Joe carried him to bed. And that was Buckley. But
why was Martin such a character?
He was always, I was going to say acting the fool, it's not quite the right way to describe it. He was quite a comedian and lived up to it all the time. He liked his drink. But then who didn't? I didn't in that day, but that stage. But I suppose it was a happy-go-lucky approach to the whole thing. We, as I say, we went down to for the investiture to Buckingham Palace. As a squadron, it was just, and the awards were made immediately rather than having to wait for them to go through the usual routine. And it was, I don't know whether it was the only one, but certainly the first that the then Queen made, because the King was in North Africa at that stage, and the Queen actually made the investiture. And I remember coming back on the train. Believe it or not, I was teetotal at that stage, so I hadn't joined in the beery jollifications and so on. And coming back on the train, my wife was with me, and we were subsidising all the rest for cups of tea because they were stony broke, so we had to cough up for the cups of tea, etc.
Any other memories of the actual raid that we've missed out?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so.
Any other raids that you did with 617?
Yes, I ended up by doing 20 trips with 617. We were re-equipped with a special bomb sight for more accurate bombing. It was the stabilized automatic bomb sight, which was, as its name implies, stabilized with gyros. And it was possible for the bomb site to actually release the bombs. The setup was such that when you set the put your settings on the bomb site, you set on height and ground speed, and you then manipulated with a couple of handles the light, the target light, so that it you've got it to in line with the target, and as the target came into the light, then these two points on the bomb site came together and the bombs were released again in distribution if it was a stick of bombs, or singly if it was a single bomb, as it often became. So from then on it was more or less special targets. We had one trip to transformer stations in northern Italy, but this was a low-level attack. And having made the attack, we then went on to Bleda, landed at Bleda in North Africa, and then flew back again a couple of days later.
What was that attack on the transformer stations like?
It was quite successful. We're using a handheld low-level bomb site for that one. And there was, even on that, there was an incident. We collected a piece of the bomb case from a bomb that had just been dropped. And it came up and lodged. It went up, came down again, and lodged just in the top of the, where the round of the nose, the Perspex nose, just lodged in there, which was close enough as far as I was concerned. And then we, how did we attack, what sort of target? Well, most of the targets that we attacked were the lights of rail bridges, rocket sites, ammunition factories, all special targets for whatever. And it was, this was where Cheshire developed the his own marking system. He did all the marking for the squadron rather than depending on PF. And he took on a mosquito to do this. He flew mosquitoes to do this. And on one of the attacks on a French ammunition factory, because it was French, and he felt very strongly that about killing the French workers, he flew over the factory several times before he marked it, and wouldn't allow anybody to bomb until he'd given time for the factory workers to get out. That's the sort of man that he was. We did another trip, and I can't remember where it was, but it was another Italian trip, and again landed at Bleda and bombed Italy again on the way back. There's one trip we were detached at one stage to Henlo to try dropping supplies to the Marquis. It was just our crew. This was normally being done by Halifax aircraft at that stage, but they wanted to see how the Lank would do it, and so we were detached on that, and we only had the opportunity to try one trip. And when we got down there, the reception committee weren't there anyway, so we had to come back again. But whilst we'd been away, the squadron had been re-equipped with the 12,000-pound armour-piercing bomb. And they had done a couple of trips on the rocket sites. We joined, having rejoined the squadron, we went then onto one of these trips, and I suppose it's the most peculiar set of circumstances that I've ever known. Bear in mind, this was the first time we had carried one of these bombs. We knew that there would be a feeling of lift once it had been released. So we went in on our attack, and bomb's gone. And I looked down. Oh, sorry, we felt a bump. I looked down and I saw a bomb going down, and I plotted it. And so we came home. One of the checks the bomb aimer had to make coming home was to flash the oldest lamp into the bomb bay to make sure all the bombs had gone. I did this. And there was this lovely bomb still sitting in the bomb bay. And so that wasn't very popular. And I went, we landed with it on, and that was a first too, landing with one of those on. And the next morning we went out for the trial drop. And as we got out to the aircraft, the bomb was already on the cradle underneath the bomb bay. And so I said to the instrument officer, what was wrong? He said, well, the bomb sight was changed during the afternoon, and there are two sockets into which it can be plugged. One is for automatic release, and the other is for manual release, i.e. pushing the button instead of waiting for the bomb sight to release it. He said the instrument character had plugged it into the manual release. So consequently, when you did your bombing run, there was no automatic release. Why didn't you press the jettison bars? I said, well, why should I press the jettison bars? It's only one bomb. We felt it go, we thought. What had happened was it had been the result of somebody else's explosion had hit us from underneath. And it was somebody else's bomb that had dropped almost simultaneously. And I was watching their bomb go down. A series of circumstances which was most peculiar.
That was £12,000.
Yeah. And that was the day before, the night before, we were going on leave, and that was my commissioning leave. I'd just been commissioned. So I was very pleased to get on that leave, in actual fact.
Did you do an operation at D-Day?
No, I'd left by then. I finished operations in April of 44. Sorry about that.
What condition were you in by the time you finished your...
I didn't think too bad. I didn't feel worn out or overstressed or anything of that nature. I went, in fact, to the five-group aircrew school at Scampton, which was a pre HCU unit for crews coming into the group. I was there as the bombing leader. I had done, during my time on 9/11,